welcome to this edition of the program. Glad you could make it. Hey, we have some weird stuff tonight. Are you ready for some weird stuff? I don't know. A lot of people say, what do you mean tonight? Your show is always weird, Malloy. Always. Yeah, I hear that. I think that's right. This program is always weird. I think one of the reasons it's weird is we don't mince words. We just, get right into it. And sometimes that comes across as weird. One of our listeners sent this to me. I don't know. This is... can I do this? I can do this one, right? About the sex toys? This is from a website. And this is legit. The number of websites selling religious-approved sex toys is rising rapidly. Rising, it says here. I think they are intending the pun. Now, according to this website, this doesn't mean that the religion-approved sex toys being offered have been officially blessed by the appropriate religious figure or institution. They're called holy sex toys, and they're the same as regular sex toys. They're just marketed in new nude images toned down boxes, using language more politically correct. Now, there's an oxymoron for you. Than one would normally find on a sex toy box. I don't know, because I don't play with sex toys, but it says the holy sex toys are not limited to any specific religion. They run the full gamut. Christians, for example, can shop at Book 22. It's named after the Bible Song of Solomon. Book 22, Hooking Up Holy or Covenant Spice and Intimacy of Eden. Jews can peruse the practically named kosher sex toys, and Muslims have the more staid-sounding El Asira, which translates the society. Now, there's a catch. To shop at these websites, buyers have to be hetero, married couples, and you have to verify this by sending a PDF copy of your marriage license to the website. How they confirm the licenses is anyone's guess. And it says here, perhaps because the holy sex toy industry is growing so quickly, some religious leaders have given them their support. A rabbi and sex therapist, David Ribner, said religious people do it like everybody else. Why shouldn't they have access to toys that make their lives more satisfying? See, I told you. The website owners say their customers often need a little guidance before they can reap the full benefits sex toys can provide. Rabbi Ribner, who also consults for kosher sex toys, says couples have often been given bad advice in the past on topics ranging from erectile dysfunction to spanking. I don't know, Kathy. I can't do this.
Holy sex toys, Batman.
Yeah, right, I know.
Can I get one shaped like a crucifix? Does it come with holy water?
Oh, stop. Stop. I can't. I don't know. Every time I think that the madness has reached its apogee, is that the highest point, or is it perigee? Apogee. Every time I think it's reached its highest point, somebody says to me, who sent it to me? Ken? In California? Every time I think the madness has just gotten to the point where, okay, it's saturated now, no more madness can be absorbed, and then, somebody sends me something like that. I don't know, man. I don't know if you heard, but yesterday in Brownsville, Texas, 15-year-old eighth grader named Jamie Gonzalez was shot and killed by police at his middle school. He was hit three times, twice in the chest, once in the back of the head. Police said they were called by school authorities because this 15-year-old boy was carrying a gun, which turned out to be a realistic-looking pellet gun. Now, if you're familiar with those, it's a weapon that uses compressed air to fire a metal pellet. That's what I use on the tree rats around my house. And you got to be careful. It might be a threat to your eye, but it doesn't pose a serious threat, you know, to anyone's life. But anyway, there's no question, or there is question, there's no question that this young man is dead, but there is the question of why three shots were fired, why they fired at the chest of a child with clear intent to kill him, and of course there's that shot to the back of the head. David Lindorf, writing at opednews.com, said, I want to call attention to another point that gets beyond this one case of overkill by police, and that is the double standard when it is an American kid and when it is foreign kids who are killed. Lindorf writes, I'm referring here to Iraq and Afghanistan, where thousands of kids, even younger than Jamie Gonzalez, most of whom were not armed, not even with a pellet gun, have been killed by American bombs and by the guns of American soldiers, and whose deaths evoke not the slightest word of sympathy from the people who issued the orders that led to their deaths. Every time I read about civilians being blown away, digressing from Lindorf's piece here, I always notice that the local military commander, usually a Brit or an American, will offer condolences to the government of whatever country now owns the corpses. Lindorf goes on, nor is there any concern about the slaughter of innocents expressed by the millions of Americans whose taxes pay for this ongoing atrocity. Take Fallujah, Iraq, a city of 300,000 that in 2004 was the scene of one of the most brutal and brutish fighting of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and what was clearly a war crime to rival anything the Nazi Wehrmacht engaged in during World War II, the Bush-Cheney administration and the Pentagon ordered the leveling of Fallujah in retaliation for the killing by resistance fighters of the four Blackwater mercenaries in the city, and then hanging their burned bodies from a bridge over the Euphrates River. Remember that? The assault on the city was a case of pure collective punishment, a tactic which is expressly declared a war crime by the Nuremberg Charter, which, as we've talked about in this program many times, was drawn up and approved by the Allies at the end of World War II and encoded in the Geneva Conventions in 1949. It's the same document, of course, that said the worst crime that a nation can commit is the crime that George W. Bush committed, an invasion of another country. It is the worst war crime because it contains within itself all of the other crimes that a nation could possibly commit. And, of course, nobody has been held responsible for that. I'm going to tell you about Fallujah, 7 years ago now. So, it's old stuff. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Biblical Talk Radio. It's Mike Malloy.
This hour is being sponsored by Anonymous. Anonymous writes, I think Marge would be one of us, Michael, so here it goes. Please give honor to the many women who stand daily somewhere for peace. No name, just a fellow traveler on this pale blue dot. Thank you, Anonymous. Thank you for the support, and thank you for the statement. And now back to Fallujah. The assault, this is a history lesson, folks. This is what your children or your grandchildren will never hear in American history. 20 years from now, I doubt. But the assaults, plural, on Fallujah, first in April of 2004, when the onslaught was called off because of nationwide protests in Iraq over the massive civilian casualties. And then in November, when a larger and even more devastating assault was mounted that leveled nearly half the buildings in the city, also featured more war crimes, including the deliberate attack on and bombing of hospitals and the executing of captured and wounded enemy fighters. Now, you need to know this, Truth Seekers. This is Dave Lindorf writing Op-Ed News under the headline, Killing Kids is So American, because this is our legacy. I mean, come on. I know it's fun in a macabre sort of way to talk about this goddamn Santorum, and which we're going to do a little bit later, and whether or not Ron Paul is really the fascist little worm that he appears to be. I know that's great sport. But our collective soul, you see, has been so corrupted that I don't know. Maybe it's not even worth talking about. But one of those crimes that we committed in Fallujah, well documented by American reporters, though nobody in the mainstream press ever labeled what was happening as a war crime. But one of those crimes was the deliberate entrapment of all what we referred to there as combat-aged males in the city before the assault began. And a reminder, as Lindorf points out, under the Geneva Convention, all civilians must be allowed to flee the scene of a battle or impending battle. Furthermore, since 1970, all those under 18, even if they are armed fighters, are granted what is called protected status and must be offered special protection by military forces. Insert your own laugh track right there. But instead, as reported by Associated Press reporter Jim Crane, the U.S. military ordered a cordon of Marines and members of the British Black Watch Regiment to be placed around Fallujah in mid-October 2004, 3 weeks ahead of the announced assault on the city. Civilian residents were urged to flee, but they had to pass through checkpoints. After they went through the checkpoints, they were taken to heavily guarded refugee camps. And at these checkpoints, though, all males between the ages of 15 and 55 were turned back into the city. Huh? Now, since the Pentagon at the time was estimating the number of insurgents in the city of only about 4,000, it was clear that most of these boys and men were civilian non-combatants. An AP reporter, Crane, asking about this, quoted a 1st Cavalry Division officer who declined to be identified as saying of those who were denied safe passage from the future free fire kill zone, quote, we assume they'll go home and just wait out the storm or find a place that's safe, end quote. Those are easy words, but with over 10,000 buildings flattened by the ensuing U.S. blitz on the city, finding safety would have been quite a challenge. And in fact, well over 6,000 civilians were butchered in the 9-day attack in November 2004. There was no official remorse expressed at the slaughter, which included many 15-year-old boys, just like Jamie Gonzalez down in Brownsville, Texas. And younger kids, too. Not by Bush or Cheney, not by Rumsfeld or L. Paul Bremer, the jackbooted proconsul who headed up the U.S. Occupation Administration in Iraq at the time, or by any of the commanders on the ground who set the rules of engagement for the assault. Nor was there any outrage expressed by the bulk of the American people in whose name this slaughter was conducted. Instead, the victory, that's what it was referred to, was cheered, and the Marines were dubbed heroes. Apparently, for Americans, murdering young Iraqi boys and civilians in general is no big deal, any more than it is a big deal when helicopter gunships mow down kids collecting wood on a mountaintop in Afghanistan or execute sleeping students in a raided compound. Stuff happens, you know, during a war. An exception to all this is a Marine named Ross Caputo, who was part of that assault on Fallujah. I'll share with you what Marine Ross Caputo had to say when we come back.
Against the Flying Monkey Right with Mike Malloy.
So we're just taking a look back at Fallujah, city of 300,000 in Iraq that received the force of the U.S. invasion because four Blackwater employees were caught, executed, and their burned bodies hang from a bridge over the Euphrates, which sounds to me like something we would do here in the Atlanta area with invaders. We would kill them, burn their bodies, and hang the corpses over the Chattahoochee. But that's a whole different story. So thousands of people were killed in Fallujah. And the way this came up, the reason Dave Lindorf wrote about it is because of the killing of the young boy in Brownsville, Texas, yesterday in his middle school. We kill so many kids, it's no use even counting. Anyway, exception to all this is Marine Russ Caputo, a Marine who was part of the assault on Fallujah, who in a powerful message of contrition last month, published in the British newspaper The Guardian, but of course not in any major U.S. publication. And he wrote movingly that, quote, as a U.S. Marine who lost close friends in the siege of Fallujah in Iraq 7 years ago, I understand that we were the aggressors, end quote. Now, Caputo comes from a military family. He went on and wrote, quote, I understand the psychology that causes the aggressor to blame their victim. I understand the justifications and mechanisms. I understand the emotional urge to want to hate the people who killed someone dear to you. But to describe the psychology that preserves such false beliefs is not to ignore the objective moral truth that no attacker can ever justly blame their victims for defending themselves. Now, please keep in mind who is the attacker. Marine Caputo goes on, the same distorted morality has been used to justify attacks against the Native Americans, the Vietnamese, Salvadorans, Afghans. It is the same story over and over again. These people have been dehumanized. Their God-given right to self-defense has been delegitimized. Their resistance has been reframed as terrorism, and U.S. soldiers have been sent in to kill them. History, Ross Caputo goes on, has preserved these lies, normalized them, and socialized them into our culture. So much so that legitimate resistance against U.S. aggression is incomprehensible to most, and to even raise this question is seen as un-American. History, Mr. Caputo continues, has defined the U.S. veteran as a hero. And in doing so, it has automatically defined anyone who fights against him as the bad guy. It has reversed the roles of aggressor and defender, moralized the immoral, and shaped our society's present understanding of war. End quote. Marine Ross Caputo. And then Dorf closes by saying, as a society, it is time for Americans to stop condoning all this violence, particularly against children. No amount of rationalizing by police and by their bloody-minded supporters can justify the killing of Jamie Gonzalez and other children like him. And no amount of rationalization by the purveyors of fear in government and media or by the rabid neocons and neoliberals who back them and urge them on can justify America's endless, brutal, imperial wars and the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of innocent people, many of them children, that are such an integral part of them. Dave Lindorf is a founding member of This Can't Be Happening, the new independent Project Censored award-winning online alternative newspaper. You can visit the website at thiscan'tbehappening.net. This hour is being sponsored by Anonymous. And Anonymous has a message for us. The message is, I think Marge would be one of us, Michael. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know who Marge was. So here it goes, Anonymous writes, please give honor to the many women who stand daily somewhere for peace. No name, just a fellow traveler on this pale blue dot. From Anonymous. Thank you, Anonymous. So I'm looking through the Times, New York Times this morning, page A5. I flip open the paper and, oh my God, a full page, full color ad. There's Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un. Anyway, father and son. The father, of course, just died. And the son is now the dear leader. But there they are in a full color photograph and huge caps over the photograph. In North Korea, people don't get real change. And then under the photograph of these two dictators, American Union members don't either. What? American Union members? And the once and current dear leaders of North Korea linked? American Union? And then it says underneath it, fact. Here we go. Fewer than 10% of employees in unions, and there's a little asterisk next to the word unions, fewer than 10% of employees in unions voted to join their union. In most cases, the employees who voted for the union are dead or gone. The Employee Rights Act provides union members a guaranteed vote every 3 years on whether to continue paying union dues. It's time for a new Labor Day! And then a flag graphic with a star over it and big black letters ERA, which stands for EmployeeRightsAct.com. Well, and that little asterisk in little tiny letters, about 8-point cap down near the bottom of the page, private sector American unions. Fewer than 10% of employees in unions voted to join their union. Private sector American unions. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this, and then in even smaller type, it says paid for by the Center for Union Facts. The Center for Union Facts. Well, that sounds interesting. So we did, being the curious little radio talk show host that I am, we did some checking to find out about the Center for Union Facts. It's an interest group critical of union activities. It is one of several advocacy and public relations groups created by a man named Richard Berman. Berman has a lobbying firm in D.C. called Berman and Company. It specializes in research, communications, and advertising. This can be found on Wikipedia. Berman's website says he founded the CUF, the Center for Union Facts, quote, to make employees and the general public more aware of the questionable activities of labor officials, end quote. Sources used that he uses are from primary documents taken from government sources, including the Department of Labor, National Labor Relations Board, Internal Revenue Service, and the Federal Election Commission. Now, this organization was launched in February of 2006 via full-page ads in major U.S. newspapers, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. In May 2006, the organization launched its first television advertising campaign. It was a 30-second spot that ran on Fox News Channel. It featured actors posing as workers, saying that what they love about unions, like paying dues, union leaders, fat cat lifestyles, and discrimination against minorities. Yeah. The ad campaign cost $3 million, and it was raised from, quote, companies, foundations, and individuals that Mr. Berman won't identify, end quote. Another TV ad shown on CNN shows paid professional actors, once again, posing as large, burly union leaders, muscling their way into a worker's home. Yeah. And intimidating him into joining the union. You know, busting into his house. Labor and economics professor Harley Shaken said the effort to create an anti-union atmosphere, more generally, as opposed to business-funded ads against a particular union organizing driver's strike, is a new wrinkle. And an AFL-CIO spokesperson called the ads' accusations outrageous. In August 2006, the Center for Union Facts ran a series of advertisements in Montana, Oregon, Michigan, and Nevada attacking public employee unions. It appears that this may have been connected with ballot initiatives in those states at the same time proposing public spending caps. The Center for Union Facts is active in fighting the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. I guess most of you know what the Employee Free Choice Act is. That's to allow people to vote for a union by merely checking off a card. Just saying, yeah, I'd like to join a union. The Center for Union Facts. Well, let me do some more of this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. With a message. I think Marge would be one of us, Michael, so here it goes. Please give honor to the many women who stand daily somewhere for peace. No name, just a fellow traveler on this pale blue dot. Honor indeed. The Center for Union Facts has, of course, it's one of those AstroTurf organizations that puts out lies and deception on behalf of capitalist America. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, union workers earn 27% more than non-union workers. They're more likely to receive health care benefits than non-union workers. They are more likely to receive pension benefits than non-union workers. Unions take a strong stance on worker safety. All of those omissions cause critics to question whether the Center for Union Facts is in working to improve conditions for workers or corporate profits, of course. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. There is so much information out on this guy. Berman is, he runs Berman and Company. He has put together organizations like the Center for Consumer Freedom, the Center for Union Facts. Berman's organizations have run numerous media campaigns on the issues of obesity, smoking, mad cow disease, taxes, the national debt, drinking and driving, as well as the minimum wage. 60 Minutes has called him the booze and food industry's weapon of mass destruction. He was given the nickname Dr. Evil. The Center for Consumer Freedom serves as an advocate for restaurants, meat, dairy food processors, and alcohol. The group was formed in 1995 with funding from tobacco giant Philip Morris. The American Beverage Institute fights against laws designed to criminalize alcohol consumption. In May 2010, the Humane Society and MAD filed a complaint with the New York Commission on Public Integrity, charging the American Beverage Institute was in fact lobbying, but it failed to register with the state as lobbyists. It goes on and on here. His company, Berman's company, has challenged the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where it concerns their public health messages. They challenge the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, Mothers Against Drug Driving, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. In 2006, Berman initiated a campaign to downplay the level of mercury in fish. Their website encourages pregnant women to eat more fish, which U.S. Food and Drug Administration and U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have recommended against for years. It says reports of mercury in fish are nothing but scare tactics. I mean, you can find out about this guy by going to Wikipedia and just typing in the Center for Union Facts. So, I don't know if you were curious. I don't know if you get the Times. I don't know anything. But I opened that paper today and saw a picture of the once and current dictator of the most repressive nation on earth, North Korea. And a straightforward linking between those two dictators and the union movement in this country. Full page ad in the New York Times costs, what, $250,000? $500,000? I'm not sure anymore. But the assault on freedom in this country by the right wing, by the capitalists, by the corporatists is like an attack on Fallujah in Iraq. No prisoners. This is. I mean, are you aware? Are you aware of it? What is going on in the country? I mean, this constant drumbeat against everything that was decent about this country, and this continuation of the warmongering and the imperialism and the closing off of civil liberties, the destruction of human rights, the marginalizing of everybody who is not a white, Christian, evangelical, conservative, right-wing, goddamn maniac. Do you get this? Do you get the sense? No? You don't notice this? Too busy talking about texting and pictures you took on your vacation and how to operate your new iPad? Is that what it is? Mitt Romney, what's his name? Santorum. He was on O'Reilly. Was it last night, Kathy? We'll play this for you after the break at the top of the hour. I didn't know about this until Dr. Saxman, who plays in the Count Basie Orchestra, sent me a link to it. And Dr. Saxman was trying to control himself when he wrote to me. But Santorum, like most white conservatives, has at best a patronizing attitude toward people of color, and at worst would like to go back to the plantation system And he was speaking in, if you look at the video, he was speaking in front of a bunch of white people in, was that New Hampshire or was that Iowa? I think it was Iowa. And he was talking about black people. Like this pasty-faced son of a bitch would have any understanding of people of color in this country at all, which he doesn't. But he was talking about black people, and he used the term black in reference to people. And then he went on O'Reilly the next night and said he never said that, because somebody pointed out that his statement was not just inherently racist, but was overtly racist. Well, we'll play both clips for you. When we come back, we will play what he said and then what he said he said on the O'Reilly program. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Jim Cook.
It is 7 past the hour. This is a Malloy program. Okay, so here's the setup. This occurred in Manchester, New Hampshire. And Rick Santorum yesterday defended votes and statements that are earning him a second look for the wrong reason. Santorum, a former senator and House member, finished 8 votes behind Romney in that ridiculous event in Iowa. And he arrived in New Hampshire to questions about his support for home state spending projects known as earmarks, and for a recent comment about black folk that has been criticized as being racially insensitive. So Santorum went over to Fox News, you know, this garbage dump where all these people go, and sat down with Bill O'Reilly to deny that he even used the term black in reference to people in his screed against Medicaid and welfare. All right, we're going to play the clip. Listen, you just listen to what you hear. This is Santorum in Iowa.
The state of Iowa is going to get fined if they don't sign up more people under the Medicaid program. They're just pushing harder and harder to get more and more of you dependent upon them so they can get your vote. That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money.
Right.
And provide for themselves and their families.
Well, I don't want to, what did he say? I don't want to...
giving them somebody else.
Yeah, let's hear it again.
That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money.
Okay, giving them somebody else's money. Give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money. See what I mean about plantation mentality? This racist son of a bitch, they're all like this. Every single Republican, either office holder or not office holder, they're all like this. So he goes on Fox News with Bill O'Reilly. And He tells O'Reilly he never said it. Let's play the O'Reilly clip.
You were talking about welfare. And the point you were trying to make, because I want to be fair to you tonight, is that, look, we got to get away from this entitlement society. We got to get people back to work and give them an incentive rather than giving them a reason not to work. But you threw in black people when most of the people, as you know, on welfare are white people. You think that's going to be a problem?
I looked at that. And I didn't say that. If you look at it, what I started to say is a word and then sort of changed and it sort of came out. And people said, I said black. I didn't. No one in that audience, and I've talked to a lot of people.
No, we looked at it, and it is a little blurry.
I looked at it very closely. All right. It is.
So I'm going to take you on your word.
I don't use the term black very often. I use the term African-American more than I use black. And
he doesn't use the word black. He uses the term that starts with an N and ends in an R. That's what he usually uses. I mean, he's a white Republican. All right, listen what he says again. You tell me.
That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money.
Black people. What do you got against blah people? What happened was very obvious what happened. He caught himself on the K. He knew what he was saying. I don't think we ought to get blah. Did I say that? You know, it's one of those instantaneous moments of recognition. In Rick Santorum's necrophiliac brain, he realizes that he's saying something that's going to bite him on the ass. So he tries to say, well, I was referring to blah people. Blah people.
Because we all know that blah, dull, boring people are the ones most likely to be on public assistance.
That's right. Blah people.
He doesn't like blah people.
So play it again. Play the.
That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make blah people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money.
You want them to go get a job, right, Rick? The blah people. The boring people. You're not talking about African Americans because you don't use that term. You don't call people of color, black people, you know. And now let's hear again what he said on O'Reilly's program, because I like the way he says this. This is funny. You got it?
I looked at that, and I didn't say that. If you look at it, what I started to say is a word and then sort of changed, and it sort of came out. And
you weaselly son of a bitch.
So he doesn't like blue people.
He doesn't like blue people. I looked at it and I didn't say that. What I started to say was a word and it sort of changed to sort of blah come out. And people said I said black. I didn't. You go, Santorum. A couple more primaries and your ass is going to be back trying to sell whatever it is you sell anyway.
Collecting dead babies in jars.
Oh, my God. So I got the email today from Dr. Sachs, who obviously plays saxophone in the Count Basie Orchestra, you know, sends me emails and pictures from all over the planet. I mean, what a job is that, huh? He travels, musician who travels the world. And he sends pictures to me from Japan and from Greece and from, you know, wherever he's playing, pictures that he's taken. And but what he wrote to me today, it just said, I don't have the email in front of me, but he was alluding to the fact that his head was about to explode. And, of course, my answer to that is, come on. You're the sax man. What do we have here? I think what I ought to do here, I've got a thing from Prairie, too. Where did I put it? Kathy, where'd you hide that? Mr. Troll goes to Washington. Okay. This is from Prairie, too. Have we got time to squeeze? I think we do. Mitt Romney got called out by a Fox interviewer, of all places, for his promise to cut taxes for the middle class. Is this the one that Prairie 2 just sent? I think. Let me see. Hold on. Here it is. Here it is. This came in the other day, and I never got to it. So let's just put that one aside. This is one I got from Prairie 2 today. He writes, the biggest payroll processing firm is estimating that the private sector created 325,000 jobs in December. This would be consistent with the weekly jobless claims number that had been remaining well under 400,000 for several weeks. Conservative business news outlets are suggesting this estimate be taken with a grain of salt, and that we should wait for the government survey of employers coming out tomorrow. The thing about that employer survey number is that it has been deviating further and further from the Labor Department survey of actual working households. According to actual workers, the private sector created 500,000 jobs in November. tomorrow could be a bad day for Republicans when the December numbers come out. Let me digress. Why do you think Prairie 2 is saying it could be a bad day for Republicans? Because jobs are being created. Back to Prairie 2. Reports from the manufacturing sector suggest strong growth in December, this being the 29th straight month of improvement. Of course, new U.S. Manufacturing jobs only pay $15 an hour if you're lucky. Manufacturing jobs in Germany pay $56 an hour. Their new unemployment numbers are the lowest since Mr. Gorbachev tore down that wall. Here, the Republicans who take credit for the reunification of Germany, even though they did nothing to had nothing to do with it, are getting ever richer while the middle class descends to the level of East Germany. Maybe Mr. Gorbachev could be persuaded to hook up with Germany, or maybe it's time to march our own Caucasus type Caucasus types out in front of the tanks. Ceausescu types out in front of the tanks. He's referring to Romania in 1989. All right, there's more here, and thank goodness there's a good break point because we have to take a break here. I thought he was saying Caucasus. It's Ceausescu types. Okay, we'll be right back. Stay with us. Oh my goodness. Timing is everything, right?
Against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Okay, back to Prairie 2. He's talking here about the new numbers, new jobs produced, and how it's bad news to the Republicans. And then Bruce goes on. Mitt Romney's spokesman says he created 100,000 jobs for the head of Bain Capital. They give no numbers for how many jobs were destroyed by Mitt, deliberately bankrupting companies after stripping them of their assets to take as booty, I mean profit. The bulk of the jobs he claims that he created were at the office supply chain, Staples. But this was not any sort of innovation that created new jobs. This was simply the Walmartization of the office supply business, destroying thousands of mom-and-pop businesses that have provided excellent pay for generations. Now the next generation can work for minimum wage, and or even if they manage to go to college, half of them are unemployed or working at Staples. Out here on the prairie, global warming is working quite nicely. It was 61 degrees this evening, shattering all previous records. The farmer across the road is running a caterpillar to groom his drainage. Normally, the temperature would be between 30 and minus 20 this time of year, and the ground is frozen rock solid, several feet deep. The night crawlers are still on top of the ground. I could catch them and go fishing. The regular kind of fishing. There's no ice. That is, if the fish were safe to eat. You know, you can eat worms. They're high in protein. I keep a few chickens. They like the worms better. Prairie2.com. P.S. Santorum left Iowa just in time to avoid the fire raining down. A state court judge has ruled today in favor of a married lesbian couple, compelling the state to issue a birth certificate for their born-in-wedlock child with both women's names as the parents. This is routinely done for a hetero mixed couple, regardless of the actual father of the baby. Cats and dogs are shacking up everywhere. Oh, the humanity. Prairie 2 is going to have to convert his upper Midwest farmland to date palm groves here pretty soon. All right. Where are we? Oh, I have an email here that I want to share with you when we come back after the next break. It's from Tom in Joshua Tree, California. And it is also about National Defense Authorization Act that was passed by overwhelming majorities in the House and the Senate, almost unanimously in the Senate, and then signed into law New Year's Eve by President Obama. And we've talked quite a bit about this over the course of its being considered by the House and passed, being considered by the Senate and passed, and the promises, once again, that Barack Obama, who is either he's a liar or he thinks the American people are so stupid that we forget when he says, well, I'm not going to sign something that has in it presidential authority to arrest American citizens and detain them without charge indefinitely. I'm not going to sign that. And then he signs it. But he adds with it a signing statement that has absolutely no weight, no force of law whatsoever. It's a weasel's way out. Most presidents have done this. When they sign bills into law, rather than vetoing them, usually exercising their duly granted constitutional power, rather than do that, they go ahead and sign something that they know sucks big time, but they add a signing statement, which means nothing. It's like when you were a kid and your mother said, don't eat any cookies before dinner. And as soon as she walked out of the kitchen, you grabbed cookies and ate them. And then you said to yourself, well, she didn't say which dinner. That's called a signing statement, in a manner of speaking. So it's just... I don't know. You know, I'm feeling that feeling again, right, Kathy? I need to get into a different business. Roofing contractor. I did that when I was a kid. We used to spray on roofs. This black, pitchy tar crap. Oh, God. I used to breathe that stuff in. That's why I get these bronchitis attacks, I'm sure. So I'm breathing all that stuff. We'll be right back, and I want to share with you an email from Tom in Joshua Tree, California. All right? Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Radical Talk Radio, it's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour from Tom in Joshua Tree, California. New year in a new America. This is about the NDAA. On December 14th, 2011, President Obama thanked our troops at Fort Bragg, North Carolina for all their fine service and capped off the cheers with God bless you all, God bless your families, and God bless the United States of America. The very next day, a nearly unanimous multimillionaire Senate and a House count of 283 to 136 codified the National Defense Authorization Act that effectively overrides the Constitution and cancels our Bill of Rights. It is what George Washington University constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley calls, quote, one of the greatest rollbacks of civil liberties in the history of our country, end quote. It also was a highly charged symbolic gesture, since that day was the 220th anniversary of the ratification of America's Bill of Rights. Put simply, the NDAA declares that America is in a global war on terror and designates America as an international battlefield so that all citizens and residents alike are now subject to indefinite military detention, interrogation, and execution without charge, representation, or trial. It also eliminates any need for the president or his military to justify, prove, or account for their actions or the fate of those detained. And this, while the rest of us either slept or partied the night away, is what President Obama signed into law December 31st, 2011. So, as a freeborn American with a dedicated belief in and reverence for the Constitution of the United States, I'm forced into a quandary, and I'm left to ask, what now? Is America now without its Constitution? What now? Is an America without our Bill of Rights, both of which were expressly written to provide and defend American liberty during all times of peace and war? Furthermore, how does this uphold the presidential oath of office to defend and protect the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic? Has America been disappeared? I ask because the only other countries that practice the indefinite detention of its citizens without trial include nations such as Myanmar, which has held its elected General Secretary, Aung San Suu Kyi, under house arrest for over 20 years. And another one is our ally Saudi Arabia, that just last month beheaded a woman who was accused of witchcraft. China, our most favored trading partner, regularly arrests and imprisons its citizens on suspicion of anti-state sentiments. Other countries that have fallen into this category are North Korea, Castro's Cuba, Pinochet's Chile, Hitler's Germany, and Stalin's Russia. It was our third president, Thomas Jefferson, who said, quote, when governments fear the people, there is liberty. When the people fear the government, there is tyranny, end quote. I will not argue against that assertion, nor will I question Obama's sincerity when he says that his administration will not authorize the disappearance of American citizens, though he already has. However, it is not the use, but the right to use such powers that defines the totalitarian system. What about the next president? Or the one after? Martin Niemöller was a German pastor and theologian who was liberated from Dachau by the Allies in 1945. He is known for the following piece of poetry that has become a model for describing the dangers of political apathy. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. Tom in Joshua Tree, California. You know, I'm really struck by the fact, thanks, Tom, I'm struck by the fact that this has gotten so little comment or attention. This NDAA, let's assume that Barack Obama And I don't know why we would assume this. I was going to say, let's assume he's true to his word. He is not true to his word. He has shown time and time and time again, whether it was marching with union people in Wisconsin and his refusal to do so, even though he promised such action, whether it was including a public option in his health care plan, which he promised to do and then refused to do. No matter what the deal is, Barack Obama always backs down. Now, if you want to make an argument that it's because of his youth or his racial composition or his unwillingness to confront the white establishment and tell him to kiss his multicolored ass when he has to, you can attribute it to anything. And sometimes I attribute it to the fact that he is just another president of the United States who is owned and operated by corporate America. I don't know. I have no damn idea. All I know is what Barack Obama has promised to do, he has not done. And there are a million reasons. Okay. We can go right down the list. Well, he has a recalcitrant Congress. He has a Senate that wants to see him out of office no matter what. He has a military-industrial establishment that will Kennedy him if he's not careful. Go down the list. Then maybe he should stop making the promises. And just be a good corporatist president, do his 8 years, and get the hell out and go make his money. Go get paid. Like every president has done. Look how Clinton's gotten paid since he got out of the White House. At one time, I can remember when the Clintons, both Hillary and Bill, reports said that they were on the verge of bankruptcy, had no money, nothing. Do you know how many millions that man is worth now? So, okay, Barack, go for it. Do what Bill did. Do what George did. But why do you keep doing this? Why, Mr. President, do you keep tightening the noose around your fellow countrymen? Why do you do this? What the hell is going on here? I don't give a goddamn if you're the first Green president. You're the president of the United States. You took an oath. Why are you doing this? And aside from your official function, why are you doing things you said you would not do? What happens to somebody when they become president of the United States? Remember when George W. Bush swore back in the late 90s, right before his Supreme Court buddies gave him the election for free? Remember what he said he's going to be? Remember the term compassionate conservative? Don't choke. Remember that? Compassionate conservative. And the next thing he does is set up the murder of hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle East. The absolute slaughter, murder of innocent people. That's what we're talking about last hour, Fallujah. Hello? What happens to these people when they become president? But what is shocking to me is how, once again, you can see how filthy and corrupt every single network is in this country, news network, and every single person who works for them. And yes, I know I'm including some hallowed liberals, but God damn them all. Nobody is talking about this. We see a whole panel of people at CNN and MSNBC and ABC and CBS and sitting around talking about this ridiculous dog and pony show in Iowa. And now they're on to New Hampshire. And it goes on and on and on. And meanwhile, the President of the United States is signing us into a fascist dictatorship. And all the liberals clustered over at MSNBC, being all jokey and oh yeah, oh let's talk about Rick Santorum, oh let's talk about this, oh let's talk about that, oh 8 votes, wow that's really funny, hor. What about? They're like a bunch of goddamn high school children sitting around in a lunchroom gossiping about, the most popular boy and the ugly girl and this one and that one and Barack Obama signs us into tyranny. I'm having one of those periodic events, Kathy, where I really, really question what the hell you and I are doing, this program. I am serious as a heart attack. And if you're a regular listener to this program, you know, I hear people that go, oh, goddamn, he's going to get into that again. Yeah, apparently so. I don't know. It's just so difficult. I've got columns, articles here from the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz and Global Research and Reg over at TVNewsLies.org sent it to me, and Sheila at Op-Ed News, and everybody said the U.S. is sending thousands of troops over to Israel for exercises, missile teams. It's called Austere Challenge 12. And we're going to send an entire, the Israeli military says it will soon hold a major missile defense exercise with U.S. forces. And they say that this has been planned long ago, has nothing to do with recent events in the Middle East. More on this when we come back. The U.S. military and the Israeli military are doing. I think this is the first time that's ever happened, right? The drill is called Austere Challenge 12. Who thinks this stuff up? It's designed to improve defense systems in Israel. Israel has deployed the Arrow missile defense system, jointly developed and funded with the U.S., which is designed pretty much exclusively to intercept Iranian missiles. Who else is going to fire a missile, right? Yesterday, Wednesday, Iranian Defense Minister Ahmad Vahidi said that Iran planned to hold more military exercises after this most recent 10-day drill in the Persian Gulf. Now, Haaretz doesn't make too big of a deal about it. They just say, "Well, you know, we're going to get together with the Americans, and we're going to do this." The Jerusalem Post has it a little differently. You know, the Jerusalem Post has more of a saber-rattling sound to it. Damn it, what am I trying to say? Saber-rattling. Jerusalem Post is more right-wing, and, of course, Haaretz is more liberal or what have you. So, now, if we're to believe the official story coming from the Israeli government and a spokesman for the U.S. military. I don't know if anybody in the Obama administration or the State Department has, or the Defense Department for that matter, here in the States has said anything officially. Apparently somebody in, general rank, a U.S. military general stationed in Germany is making the official statements about all this, which is, very suspect, because something of this size and this nature, you would think that the Secretary of Defense, Panetta, who was just out there today all over media talking about how they're going to reduce expenditures for military hardware, and they're going to cut back on the number of military personnel and blah, blah, blah. which gives the Republicans more to scare the hell out of their brain-dead, cowardly followers with, right? I mean, you know, this is just, you do realize, don't you, that we are being prepped for war with Iran. I mean, there's no doubt here. This is not just, oh, come on, maybe that's a toss-up, Mike, but no. We are being prepared for it the same way we were prepared for it against Iraq. I'm telling you, only there's a bit of a difference here. Iran is not Iraq, for one thing. Iran never allowed itself to be sucked into that the thing with the United States that Saddam was willing to get sucked into, which took away all of his strength. I'm not saying that Saddam should be sympathized with. He was a dictatorial son of a bitch like certain people in this country. But he allowed himself to be enfolded in that lethal embrace that is U.S. foreign policy. Man, when we want somebody or their country or their resources, we have ways to, you know, come here, psst, come here, buddy. Tell you what, you got some rebels up there in the north, right? Okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to provide you with all kinds of weaponry to kill the sons of bitches, okay? That's how it starts. And the next thing you know, the leader of one of these pissant countries all of a sudden finds himself totally owned and operated by the United States military industrial machine. And then, you know, he gets an idea in his head, well, this is getting a little bit too cozy. I think I'm going to go my own way. And that's usually the point at which we invade, overthrow, kill him, destabilize his currency, ruin his economy, or just, you know, kill hundreds of thousands of his people. We've done this so many times. Iran is next. The difference is Iran never got sucked into the U.S. embrace. Oh, they had to deal with the Shah from 1950, middle 50s until 1979, till the second Iranian Revolution. But for the past 31 years, no, 32 years, whatever it's been, they didn't buy into the U.S. bat squeeze. Even though one of the countries that was most sympathetic and really shocked when we took the hit, arranged by the Bush crime family, when we took the hit on September 11th, 2001, the Iranians were some of the most sympathetic, poured into the streets by the hundreds of thousands. Do you remember the pictures? Okay, tens of thousands. In sympathy for what happened to us. The Iranians are Persians. And the people who, if you believe the official story, who attacked us are Saudis. They are Arabs. The Iranians are not Arabs. They are Persians. There is a difference. We are being prepped for an invasion of Iran. So get used to the idea. And we are about to send, if the published reports are correct, and there's no reason they are not, because they're coming from really reliable sources, we're about to send thousands of military personnel, thousands, thousand with an S on it, thousands of military personnel to Israel. We're going to switch topics and be back momentarily. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. You can make the argument that the Occupy movement has just about single-handedly raised awareness in this country about income inequality. And the probability or the possibility of people moving from a lower economic situation in this country to a higher economic situation. That was always the American dream, right? You may be too young to have been told this, but anybody born before, 1970? Was told that by their parents, at least I was, maybe you were, maybe most, I think most people were in this country, that the dream, the American dream, the American dream, sorry, I don't mean to be cynical, but that the American dream was that kids, the next generation, would do better than the previous. In other words, you would, you'd have a better shot at what the Americans considered to be the good life being one replete with material crap. A house too big, a car too big, energy usage too great per capita. You know what I'm talking about. Like I said, I hate being a cynic, but that was the American dream. That in this country, we had a right to most of the world's resources converted to our use. We had a right. I don't know who granted this right. I guess this is part of the American exceptionalism or manifest destiny or God likes us better than he likes, or, you know, people in where? Pick a country. So since we were favored by Jesus and his dad, we had a right to all these things. That's pretty twisted, but that's what we were brought up with, right? American exceptionalism. And that has been dashed to the ground. Not because it was phony to begin with, but because the greedheads who put that theory into play to begin with in order to increase their own wealth have now decided, that's the capitalists, yeah, the capitalists, they've now decided that, okay, that's enough for you Americans. Jesus, you know, we let you have the illusion of stability and middle class permanence and a little bit of wealth. We let you accumulate a little bit of wealth, and now you want more. No, we want more. We are the 1%. So the Occupy movement has been foremost in explaining to Americans very simply, very succinctly, very much to the point, the 99%, that's you and me, and the 1%, that's them. Now, of course, right-wingers also always refer to this as, class warfare, when in fact it's right-wingers who perpetrate class warfare against the rest of us to begin with. But that's an old tactic. It's one that the right-wingers, Republicans, conservatives always use. You're trying to destroy marriage because you want gay folk to be able to get married, when in fact heterosexuals have made a mishmash of marriage ever since marriage was instituted. Right? I mean, it's heterosexuals who drive the divorce rate and the infidelity rate and the murder rate, you know, murdering spouses, not homosexuals, but that's a whole different topic. But that's the way it always goes. Religious nuts can point the finger and say, well, you're going to burn in hell because you don't believe the way I believe. My way's the best way. My way's the right way. Oh, okay. But I digress. So, American exceptionalism always told people, well, look, life's going to be better for you. And when you grow up, you tell your kids life's going to be better for them. And we'll just keep this going. We'll just keep this. This is the beauty of capitalism in its relatively early stages, not early stages, but before it has had a chance, capitalism's had a chance to totally exploit and destroy workers and resources and the environment. Once that all happens, then, you know, the curtain's pulled back and little gnarled little bastard that is running all the levers and gears and dials of capitalism is exposed. He's being exposed. Upward mobility. You remember the George Jefferson song, moving on up to that penthouse. Remember that? Well, the Times this morning had a pretty good article about how it's now harder for Americans to rise from the lower rungs, that ladder of success. Remember that? Oh, my God. Now, you have to be over a certain age to know what the hell I'm talking about. The ladder of success. Like I say, if you were born before 1970, you probably, or born after 1970, this probably doesn't ring too familiar to you. But we were all taught that. There was a ladder you had to climb. And there are ways to get up the ladder. Either by birthright, you know, you were born with already on the top rung. People like George W. Bush, who was it, former governor of Texas, was it Kate, former governor of Texas, Democrat woman, forget her last name. She said, in referring to George W. Bush, she said, you know, George Bush was born with a silver foot in his mouth. Kind of a play on the fact that Bush never had to work for a goddamn thing in his life. Always people bailing him out. Well, you know people like that. The upper class in this country always has a bailout system ready to go. Always. And those of us in the lower classes had to struggle for everything. So when you hear people, especially the upper classes, talk about, well, you know, I've worked for everything. No, you didn't. But I digress again. It is getting harder and harder, if not impossible, for Americans in the lower rungs of economic stability or instability to move up. And there are many reasons for that. But researchers now have not reached a conclusion that turns conventional wisdom on its head. According to the Times, Americans enjoy less economic mobility than their peers in Canada and much of Western Europe. Less upward mobility and the possibility of upward mobility. Now, it's referred to as the mobility gap. It's been widely discussed in academic circles, but what we're going through in this country, this continuation of mass unemployment, mass underemployment, all of the sourness that has come to define the American system, and the fact that the street protests are identifying this for us, all of this has come together and pushed this discussion to center stage, so that it's no longer possible to pretend that there's a ladder and there's a way to climb the ladder. There used to be. Even a right-wing freak like Rick Santorum, a right-wing publication like National Review, a super right-wing freak like Paul Ryan, a Wisconsin Republican. These two people in this magazine have all agreed that upward mobility from the very bottom is almost impossible if you live in the United States. And they are, and their ilk are the ones who have made it impossible. More on this when we come back. Stay with us.
Everything costs so much money. 'Cause I'm-
past the hour, harder for Americans to rise from the lower rungs. That's what the New York Times says in a lengthy article this morning. And the article is based on evidence now put together by sociologists and researchers, economic researchers, who have come to the conclusion that if you live in this country, if you live in this society, this economic political system that is predatory capitalism at its finest or worst, depending on your point of view, you don't have much of a chance to, you know, the old bootstraps thing. Liberals, of course, have talked about this for a long time. The attention being paid to this from these right-wing morons is relatively new. I think the political right in this country, that part of it that is just crazy and hasn't yet been completely absorbed by the capitalists. I'm talking about people like, you know, the libertarians from the Cato Institute, the Ron Paul types. They're insane because their policies are just total nonsense. But they come from more of the social libertarianism rather than the or the political libertarianism rather than the economic poison that has been injected into the body politic here by capitalism. So what the research is beginning to say, one reason for the mobility gap may be the depth of American poverty. The what? Yeah, the depth of American poverty. The numbers have been published repeatedly over the past year. We've talked about them on this program over the past couple of years. Hell, I can remember talking about this during the Reagan years. Poverty in America. Upwards of 60% of Americans now live in poverty, or what is now referred to by the sociologists as it's a new category called near poverty. Your income may be up around $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 a year, your family income. But if one of the earners, and God forbid both, within the family, all of whom are, say, contributing $20,000 or $25,000 per year toward that kitty, if one or more of those earners all of a sudden can no longer bring in the loot, bang, into poverty you go. And everything that goes along with that, the inability to maintain health insurance, the inability to maintain mobility, I mean literal mobility, like a car, the inability to maintain your mortgage payment, homelessness staring you in the face. These are really delicate, touchy times, and the issues that brought this to us and the way to get out, none of this is being discussed. What we're talking about is whether or not there should be a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. What we're talking about, at least the political class, whether or not there should be a consumer protection division to make some of this predatory nonsense stop. We're not talking about the real problems, are we? Of course not. And I don't think we ever will. But anyway, American poverty seems to be one, if not the major reason for the mobility gap, the upward thing, the climb the ladder thing. It leaves poor children starting especially far behind. And as the Times says, another reason may be the unusually large premiums that Americans pay for college degrees. Have you taken a look at what it costs to get a college education these days? I'm not talking about the trade schools. I'm not talking about the two-year. I'm not talking about the online, even though some of them are getting expensive. But, and I'm not necessarily talking about private universities. Those are priced so far out of reach of the average person as to render them, I don't know, some fantasy. I'm talking about just state universities. Do you realize how much it costs? What the costs are to go to a state university? Why have we placed education so far out of the reach of the so-called upwardly mobile American public? Why is education now something reserved for, well, the upper classes? What's the theory behind that? You got any ideas? Could it be that the 1% or the 5% don't want mass education? Because once you are educated, are you going to be satisfied with a $10 an hour job working at some fast food restaurant or a phone call center? No, you won't be. You're going to be organizing. You're going to be thinking. You're going to be using your head. You're going to start saying, hey, wait a second. Remember, revolution always comes out of the middle class. It always does. And the middle class always has been and continues to be educated. So what do? We've talked about this for years on this program. You absolutely destroy the middle class if you want to consolidate your right-wing revolution, your capitalist takeover of everything. It's really kind of simple.
And to rearrange the way you think, hesitate, lose control, and you will sink. Think fast, think for yourself. What the world be wrong now, because it is so. It's so full of greed, because it is so. It's so, so much need for independence, solidarity, unity.
Do you want?
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Here we are together. 25 before the hour. We're talking about this upward mobility gap, this income gap that Occupy America now, the Occupy movement has been talking about for some time. Now, five large studies have found that the United States is less upwardly mobile in terms of getting out of poverty or getting out of low income brackets than comparable nations. A project led by an economist at a Swedish university found that 42% of American men raised in the bottom fifth of incomes stay there as adults. And that shows a level of persistent disadvantage much higher than in Denmark, where it's 25%, Britain, where it's 30%, and Britain is a country famous for its class constraints, right? Again, this is in the New York Times this morning. Meanwhile, just 8% of American men at the bottom rise to the top fifth. That compares with 12% of the British, 14% of the Danes. All right, I can go on with these stats all night, and they won't mean anything. Or they're just gibberish. You know, after a while, your eyes glaze over. I know mine do, and I just, you know, eh. But here it is in hard numbers. Policies that have been promoted by Republicans, a political party that is a wholly owned subsidiary of capitalism, and Democrats that is an almost wholly owned subsidiary of capitalism, those policies are destroying the American middle class. And not just destroying the American middle class, but destroying, taking the rungs out of the so-called ladder. It's no longer going to be possible if this continues to climb that ladder. If one assumes that climbing the ladder, the economic ladder, is a good idea to begin with. I don't think we ever had a debate about that one, did we? Liberals often complain that the United States has unusually large income gaps, as the Occupy movement does. Conservatives have argued that our system, predatory capitalism, is fair because mobility, the ability to work your way out of this garbage imposed on you by capitalism, mobility, conservatives say, is exceptionally high. Everyone can climb the ladder. And now, of course, the evidence says that that is just another pack of conservative lies. Conservatives, the organizing principle of conservatism is either hypocrisy, or lies, probably both. This is what they feed on. This is what nourishes conservatism. Lies and hypocrisy. I challenge it. Tell me I'm wrong. Send me an example. Show me where that is wrong. I say this over and over again. And never. The only emails I get from conservatives are snotty, cuss word filled attacks on me or Kathy or Molly. You know, never, ever. Do conservatives or right-wingers or libertarians ever rise to the challenge that I put out there every single night? Show me. I started saying this 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Show me where one single policy that is truly conservative has ever benefited the American public. Just one. John Bridgeland, the former aide to George W. Bush, who helped start something called Opportunity Nation, which was an effort to seek policy solutions. That must be a right-winger that still has at least a tiny shred of civic responsibility left. Anyway, he said he was shocked. Shocked by what these reports are showing about the death of mobility, economic upward mobility in this country. Bridgeland said, Republicans will not feel compelled to talk about income inequality, but they will feel a need to talk about a lack of mobility, a lack of access to the American dream. Why? Why should they talk about it? They're the ones who caused it. They're the ones who perpetuate it. They're the ones who keep it going. What are some of the causes? Well, one of the causes of this lack of mobility, the United States, among all the so-called industrialized nations, maintains a thinner safety net than other countries like ours. And in some instances, the safety net has been totally dissolved, which has the immediate effect of leaving children more vulnerable to debilitating hardships, not to mention the single mothers or the single fathers or even the married couples who are struggling, whether those couples are gay or not gay. It doesn't make any difference. Shredding the social safety net, which is a goal of conservatism since the social safety net was put together 80 years ago. Destroy it. Because it helps develop a middle class. And when you have a strong middle class, eventually, in a capitalist system, you have people who start to question the system itself and say, wait a second, wait. Why do some of us in this capitalist system have all the wealth and the rest of us struggle? It's a constant. Why do we have this inequality? See, eventually, when you have an educated middle class, those questions start to come up. And, of course, the capitalists don't want those questions to come up. Oh, my God. So they label anyone who brings up those questions as a communist or socialist or he didn't have a birth certificate. He was born in Kenya or, you know the whole list. The destruction of unions. The United States has less unionized workers than many of its peers. That means lower wages among the least skilled. And when you have lower wages, you have lower or less chance of opportunity, less chance of buying your way out of poverty. How do you buy your way out of poverty? Education. But don't forget, education is almost, higher education is almost beyond the reach of the average working American. If you have unionized workers, and if you have education, then you're going to have less public health problems like obesity and diabetes, which can limit education and employment. You're going to have people who are more aware of what they have to do and have the time and the resources to do something about what they have to do in order to stay healthy, whether that is more trips to the physician, your doctor, to be checked, to be tested, or it's a healthier lifestyle, it's exercise, it's getting out and running or walking or moving around. But if you're working two or three jobs, or if you're trying to maintain a single-parent household, where do you find the time to do that? How do you do it? And as the research is reporting, perhaps another break on American upward mobility is the sheer magnitude of the gaps between the rich and the rest of us, which is the central theme of the Occupy protests. Countries with less equality generally have less mobility. It's as simple as 2 + 2 = 4. And the report seemed to indicate that the stagnation that is occurring is going to worsen. Most of the studies end with people born before 1970, while the wage gaps in single motherhood and incarceration increased beyond 1970. And the researchers are saying, you know, until more data arrive, we don't know the half of it. That's another thing, the incarceration rate in this country. The United States has a uniquely high incarceration rate and a longer history of racial stratification than countries similar to ours. So all of this works together. Let's lock more people up. Let's destroy more minorities. Let's sever even further the last few strands of the social safety net. Let's end unionized workers. Let's end public unionized workers. Let's end it all. Let's crash it into the goddamn ground so that the top 1% can continue to suck off every single piece of the American dream. The American dream, huh? Just thought you'd like to know this stuff, you know, just another example of how depressing it can be to come to this program and get a cold shower of truth. It's not my truth. It's the truth. Such an attempt is going on. You know, my criticism of Obama is pretty thorough on so many different levels. I don't think Obama, though, is quite the beast that the average Republican is. I do believe that Obama is constrained and restrained by the corporate power structure, the capitalist power structure that assisted his getting to be president. I think they're going to make sure that he is elected again to serve another 4 years. But I do believe, I have to believe this because I haven't seen evidence to the contrary. I can listen to, let me digress for a second. I can listen to the average Republican. I can listen to Mitch McConnell or John Boehner or Eric Cantor or Rick Santorum for 5 minutes and just hear in the way they talk and their points of view and the repetition, I just hear evil crackling like a fire. You can hear it. You can hear this disgusting anti-life rhetoric that turns my stomach. When I listen to Obama, granted, I will say that 90% of his, to me, of his influence is because he is a rhetorical genius. But if you listen to Obama sometimes, I don't anyway. Let me change the pronoun. When I listen to Obama, I don't hear that evil crackling that I hear from an Eric Cantor or John Boehner, if you understand what I'm saying here. So, I think there is still part of Obama who would like to do well, but he can't. He would like to do good, I should say, but he can't. So he has become part of the problem. And the problem being predatory capitalism, because he is not doing those things to replace this horrific collusion between the economic and the political system in this country. But anyway, Obama still, every once in a while, does something to try to stop the slide into a completely broken system, economic political system. And his appointment of former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray yesterday as director of the Consumer Protection Agency has finally given that agency that was put together by Elizabeth Warren the legal standing to supervise the types of financial enterprises that is destroying the country. That's the thing about predatory capitalism. It doesn't give a goddamn about the house that it's operating within. It'll burn the damn thing down in order to get what it wants. But then it's okay, because then it involves itself in predatory capitalism, disaster capitalism. The difference between predatory capitalism and disaster capitalism is a quantitative difference. That's all. It's both of them are capitalism, and both of them will destroy everything it touches. But anyway, the appointment of Cordray is an attempt, feeble as it is, to try to take away some of the more vile and vicious attacks on the working class. The non-bank financial companies, the banking industry itself is corrupt and vile. And, you know, a cynic would make the point that all Obama is doing with this appointment is directing attention away from the real predators in this society, and that's these huge investment banks. But the non-bank financial companies are also parasitic. They also are destroying everything in the country. Now, with the appointment of Cordray, there will be a federal oversight where it concerns these lower runged predators. Now, the focus of this new bureau will be on unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices in products like private education loans. Here we go again. Prepaid charge cards. Has that turned into a ripoff? Companies like mortgage servicers, where you don't really have a mortgage with the mortgage servicer. They take care, so to speak, of your mortgage payments, and they lard on the fees. And it's just endless destruction of the middle class. So this agency is going to keep an eye on that, and maybe even take some of these sons of bitches to court. The payday lenders, short-term payday loans that carry interest rates of more than 400%. Now, the Republicans, see, they don't want any of this to stop, because these predatory companies, these capitalist companies, provide huge sums of money into the campaign chests of these Republicans. So charging 400% interest on these so-called payday loans, Republicans want that to continue. Now, the conservatives, the upper 1% in this country, would never pay 400% interest. And why not? They don't have to. They don't have to. The door to the vault is always open to them. But if you're not one of them, and you are desperately trying to hold your family together from paycheck to paycheck, and you take the chance of borrowing $500 from one of these predators, and you wind up paying back an effective interest rate, if it were figured on a yearly basis of 400%, tell me how you think you're ever going to get ahead. And the banking industry, of course, is objecting to all this. The Republicans are saying, oh, well, you know, he made a recess appointment when Congress wasn't really in recess. We were here for 14 seconds the other day. It is such a scam. The whole thing is a scam. And as we've said before on this program, the system is beyond reform. It has to be replaced. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. One side.